Views and opinions expressed during the drive time are those of Dave Glover and his guests and are not those of Northumberland 89.7. Agree, disagree, or have a comment? Call the station and speak with Dave live on the air. Call 905-372-2321. That's 905-372-2321. Now your host, Dave Glover.
Welcome back to The Drive Time. I'm your host, Dave Glover. Joining me for Consider This Live, Rob Washburn is in the studio, professor of e-journalism at Loyalist College. We are going to be talking about local stuff. Here's you too. Thank you very much, and welcome back to The Drive Time, everybody. I'm your host, Dave Glover. Joining me in the studio, as I said, is our good friend, Rob Washburn. Rob, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Dave. Good to see you again.
It's been a couple of weeks. You've been a busy, busy man, obviously.
I have indeed. It's been the end of year, you know, all kinds of meetings down at the college, and just busy, 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 getting things wrapped up and ready for next fall.
Well, one of the things you and I wanted to talk about today was this proposed medical arts center for Coburg. This is the new facility that's going to be built by the Northumberland Hills Hospital. Now, you and I have actually talked about this a couple of times because one of the concerns we've raised, and it really is a concern I don't think that's even been addressed or discussed, is this idea that we're going to move all of these doctors into one location, which is fine, except we've got a number of locations already, and what is that going to mean for the landlords?
Well, that's it. And you know what? First of all, I think it's really interesting that they've been very successful in their fundraising efforts to get investors, and they were able to raise $2.5 million. Mm-hmm. In just a couple of months, and that was an investor funding. But amazingly, too, they've been able to raise another $500,000 in what they call seed money, those things to go towards, you know, drawings for the new building, getting plans approved by council, you know, construction costs, all those kinds of things before they go ahead and actually build the building itself, which I understand is to be estimated to cost about $10 million. So they've got $2.5 million, which is $500,000 more than they had asked for. Plus, they're going to get a bank loan for about $8 million to pay for the building. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be about 40,000 square feet. So when you think about that, Dave, what about your earlier point, where is these people going to come from? Are they going to be new doctors? Are they new to the community? We haven't heard anything about that. So you start to think, well, they're going to be taking people out of existing leases and moving them into the one facility, which logistically obviously makes sense. Of course, you know, you're at the doctors, you can go to the hospital, back and forth. It's easier mm-hmm. for the doctors. There's lots of good reasons to do it. But from the town's perspective and from a real estate perspective, how is this going to affect the town?
Well, that's a very good point. And I think if listeners have any comments on this particular topic, by the way, you can give us a call at 905-372-2391 or 905-372-2321. We have our volunteer, Joanna. She is taking the calls for us. She's not screening them necessarily, but she is going to let us know when we have a call. For those of you that aren't aware, we don't have a ringing phone here in the studio. So one of the problems with regards to answering telephones here at the station has always been this issue of, well, we can't take more than one caller at a time. Now, the person who answers the telephones, thankfully, can take more than one call at the same time.
That's
so they
fantastic.
Can take a call. We can put the second caller on hold. So if you do have any questions or comments regarding the topic of today's conversation thus far, which is the proposed Coburg Medical Services building, which is the building that's being built. They say it'll be done by 2016, November 1st.
Yeah. No, now, here's something that's interesting, Dave. I tried today to find out how much commercial space we do have in Coburg right now,
mm-hmm.
and then to find out how much is available. And when I talked to economic development, I wasn't able to get an answer. They were busy with multiple attempts to phone. I sent emails, and I couldn't get an answer back in a day. So I went around and did some more digging. On the Coburg Economic Development website, there's only one property that is listed. And it's got, I think, something around 7,000 or 10,000 square feet available. Now, that's... I don't know how reliable that is. I don't know whether, you know, what the system is, that how those get up there, or whether that represents all available commercial properties. So I went looking further, and I found a national commercial real estate website. And they have a listing for 91 commercial properties. I couldn't get any details about them, but they're saying that in our area, 91 leases are available for commercial space. So again, I don't know how accurate that is. I don't know how recent that number would be.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very hard to determine how much available space is and how much is being used and whether there is a demand for this kind of space.
No, again, please understand, listeners, you know, we're not saying that a building like this isn't something that would be great and it would be useful. I mean, a lot of people know, you go to various hospitals in Toronto, for instance, or Scarborough, what have you, they always have a medical arts facility next to it. And I know that in the original plan for the Northumberland Hills Hospital, there was this discussion of whether or not this facility was viable and would be built at that time. For whatever reason, it wasn't. But we still have to take into consideration the economic impact for the property owners of the spaces that are currently being leased, whether it's the Coburg Medical Center up at William and the 401 there up by the Petro-Canada, or the place located across the street from the Coburg Collegiate Institute.
Yep.
And I believe there's at least one more in the West End.
There's another, used to be a medical arts building down on Queen Street right next to the post office.
Right.
There are many doctors that are spread out, different places, mm-hmm. different medical services. There's also in the mall, part of the Northumberland Health Team is in the lower part of the mall there.
Yep.
That's going to have an impact. I mean, I totally understand. The rationale is flawless. I mean, let's put it all in one place, make it easy for everybody to come to. There's going to be parking.
One-stop shopping for healthcare.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that makes sense. But I think from the town's perspective, when they're in a position where they're having to literally give away space, commercial space in the downtown as part of a contest to fill it up, and now all of a sudden we're going to create this glut of 40,000 square feet, and all those people are going to be moving in. Where's the soft and what's going to happen? And I think that's a legitimate question that the planners of the town and the economic development people need to step forward and say, here's what we're planning to do. Here's how this is going to work out so that we don't have another slew of empty buildings that take away from the economic aspect of our town.
No, and again, these are very important questions that have to be answered. And again, we are not saying, and I don't think anyone out there would disagree, that this is a great idea to have sort of a one-stop shopping area, or like a health mall, if you will. But by the same token, we do need to think about the impacts, because we know the vacancy rate in the downtown is a little higher than it usually is, quite frankly. You talked about the Win This Space, and we know they are just desperately trying to get people to come into the community, whether to open a small business or whether to take over an existing operation. And we're talking about spaces that are going to be vacated, by healthcare professionals. These are very specific, specialized locations, aren't they?
Absolutely. And the type of infrastructure that they need is very specialized as well. I mean, it's not just like you can go rent a storefront and open up a medical office. I mean, there's security issues. There's obviously the specialized equipment, the special electrical needs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, I mean, one of the reasons that the building was built across from Coburg East was due to the fact that it was close proximity to the hospital at the time.
Just around the corner.
And that was the whole idea of that one. So, you know, there's a lot goes into that kind of a space and using that kind of a space properly.
Absolutely. On that note, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to pay some bills. We'll be right back with more of Consider This Live here on Northumberland 89.7. You're listening to The Drive Time. I'm your host, Dave Glover. With me, Rob Washburn, the professor of e-journalism at Loyalist College.
Chris.
And welcome back to The Drive Time right here on Northumberland 89.7. I'm Dave Glover. Joining me, Rob Washburn. He is my co-host, as you know, on Wednesdays for Consider This Live. Something else that came out of council this week was a memorandum of understanding between the town of Coburg and the Northumberland YMCA, and it was approved in principle by the council on Monday night. The MOU enables the two sides to work together to explore the feasibility of building and operating a YMCA facility at the site of the Coburg Community Center. Now, the YMCA and the town have worked cooperatively together to bring the memorandum of understanding that is supported by the board at the Y, according to Teresa Rickerby. She is the counselor for Parks and Rec. The process, just so everyone knows, follows an outline similar to the CCC process that does include lots of public engagement and participation on the subcommittee that would be reporting to the project coordination team. Now, council support on Monday was just the first step as the concept of partnership opportunity is discussed and noted at press time that was issued at the meeting. Back on April 27th, the release reminded council passed a motion to endorse a request from the local YMCA board to look into the feasibility of a new facility at the CCC. So a lot of people are talking about this particular thing, especially members of the Coburg Soccer Club who are really concerned about the loss of those soccer pitches.
Well, and a legitimate concern at that. Originally, the CCC had a component that was going to include the YMCA. It was going to be built in on the front end, and it would have been an integrated building. And it's not clear whether this is going to be an extension of the existing building or a standalone building. And if it's a standalone building, then they're starting to encroach upon some of the soccer pitches in the field to the north of the existing CCC.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that I remember about the CCC when it was being developed was this discussion of a pool, and they had already saved the space to the south side of the CCC, which was going to be reserved for a swimming pool.
Yep.
I mean, let's face it, the CCC is probably more than large enough to encompass whatever the Y would need to do as far as building a separate facility goes. I got to question that. And as far as building the pool goes, well, the space has already been provided for that. If they went with the original plan that I saw, which included the pool, and then integrated the YMCA into the community center with regards to services, I mean, it seems to me that they've already got the square footage inside the CCC to be able to accommodate the Y. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, I'm sure that's going to be part of the discussions that will unfold in the days to come. Another group that has, interestingly enough, stepped forward are the seniors. They're concerned right now. There's a number of programs that are offered. They're offered at minimal or no cost at the CCC. And there is some concern that if the Y does come in and start taking over the recreational kinds of activities, is there going to be additional cost? Will it now suddenly they have to pay where they didn't have to pay before?
Will they have to get a membership to the Y?
Exactly. And so these kinds of things, you know, this has always been an interesting thing with the Y is that the town has used it as its recreation department for decades.
Yep.
And really, they have never really developed a recreation department or had run programs per se. I mean, certainly they work with the various sporting organizations, but there is not a staffer that's devoted to this. There's not a department which creates programs or tries to run programs. So they've left it up to the Y and to the individual sports organizations to organize and run these things.
Well, getting back to Monday's council meeting, there was some discussion. Deb McCarthy said she'd spoken with members of the Seniors Activity Center at the CCC, and they shared their concerns. And she said it would be her understanding that the seniors would be one of the stakeholders that would be represented on one of the public engagement committees. So that would be an opportunity for them to engage the process. Teresa Rickerby said, part of this MOU is to ensure it's accessible services for all and complementary services, not duplication of services. So the whole goal is to make sure the project would encompass everyone and not make it accessible. Make it accessible to everyone. But one of the other concerns that was raised, because people have said, I can't afford to belong to the Y. Will it be affordable for me? I mean, we made sure we addressed that particular concern at the time, and we've already had discussions, even as we go through the memorandum of understanding, that in being that the seniors may feel threatened, Brockenier said, and we know that there's something we have to deal with to make sure that they understand that this is not going to involve any hardships on them or take away anything from them that they currently have.
Well, it's interesting, too, because this, I'm going to diverge a bit here, but I think it's relevant, and that is that Coburg just went through a horrific process with the marina.
Yes.
And where they did not go out, there was not proper public consultation, there was a lot of mixed messages got sent out, there was a whole bunch of confusion, and now, as we saw on Monday night, probably the most confusing motion I've ever seen passed by Coburg Council somehow trickled through as they try to mop up the mess that they created.
I got to say, though, before we get further, because it's my understanding that the motion that was presented at Council was, in fact, an older version of the motion. But part of the problem has to do with, and I'm not pointing a finger at anybody because I understand that that Lorraine Brace, quite frankly, suffered an illness on the day of the council meeting, and the required changes to the motion that were had already been approved and put forth weren't finalized for the meeting because she wasn't able to do the job. I hope, against all hope, that Lorraine Brace, you are perfectly okay. I understand that that there was a serious health concern, and thank goodness Teresa Bain was at town hall for that to help deal with that. So again, a lot of the confusion had to deal with the fact that the initial motion that was being read was from a previous version of that motion, and then it ended up being that some councillors had the new version and some councillors had the older version. So that probably led to a lot of the confusion.
Said, though, Dave, and I appreciate what you're saying, and I too hope that Lorraine's okay. But my point was simply going to be that I think lessons learned about public consultation. And I can tell from this story that you've just been reading and from these actions that council wants to get the public engagement going early.
Yep.
They want this to be a completely transparent process, make sure all the major players are at the table, mm-hmm. and that they're going to get their input prior to anybody coming out with a set of plans or with anybody making any kinds of announcements. So I think lessons learned was going to be my point, that, you know, I think council's acting much more transparently on this and with, a much clearer process in terms of public engagement.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's exactly what they're looking for. But as it stands right now, there will be no additional slips in the West Harbor.
Well, but you know what still confuses the heck out of me is that we all know that there is infrastructure that needs to be done down there.
Yep.
East Pier, I know the Marina Gas fill-up area needs to be worked on, that there's some docks that exist that need to be repaired and fixed, et cetera, et cetera. So I guess the thing is what's going to happen to that? Are we going to be waiting or, you know, can monies be put aside now and let's get those jobs done? Because, I mean, it was only 2 years ago, Dave, that the Rotary Club was scrambling only days before the Waterfront Festival because the East Pier was deemed to be unsuitable to take certain types of rides. I mean, that East Pier is a problem, and something needs to be done about mm-hmm. it. So let's hope that the infrastructure aspect of this gets through. I don't think that's the contentious part. I think what's more contentious is the new slips. So if they can move forward without having mm-hmm. to do those new slips and get that work done, then let's hope we can move forward on
well,
that
absolutely.
Without too much grief.
Well, and as we know, Waterfront Festival is coming soon, right? We know that's around
Indeed.
The corner.
Next week.
Not this weekend, but I guess next weekend.
Next
right?
weekend, yeah. Next Wednesday it starts. 4 whole days. You all set for that?
I've got my TV ready to watch some DVR programming, and I probably won't be going down actually to the Waterfront Festival.
Well, I
gotta say, for me, it's a health issue. I mean, I can't spend a lot of time walking around. For those of you that aren't aware, I do suffer from a lung ailment that makes it almost impossible for me to walk more than a block, quite frankly. So I don't spend a lot of time outside, and to be honest with you, if I do go down, it'll probably be on the last day.
Well, I can tell you my wife and my daughter will be contributing greatly to the local economy for 4 days.
Good for them.
But you know what's interesting too, Dave, is I invited the Lions, speaking of the Waterfront Festival, I invited the Lions to come to this very show and to talk to us about what's going on with the charges and the fencing and the stages. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, they just were too busy. They were, I guess, getting ready for lots of stuff that they're trying to get ready for. And unfortunately, somebody couldn't come and talk to us. But I was looking forward to that conversation.
It is unfortunate. By the way, I want to give a shout out to the Colberg Lions Club, because we had Haley Wickenheiser was here last week. I believe it was last week. Pete Fisher couldn't be here. He had to be up at Dalewood for the event. I watched the TV Kojiko coverage of that. And I got to say, you know what? They raised a lot of money for cancer. They raised a lot of awareness. There was a lot of talk about young Grace Bowen, and she was a personal hero for so many people who attended that. So I want to thank everybody who put that together and managed to get Haley Wickenheiser here on such short notice, because I understand it was just something that was thrown together. And you know what? They performed yeoman service on behalf of the many people that need help. Brian, whose name completely just flew out of my head, he said when they decided to put the program together, he said he picked up his phone, and within a few hours, they had the commitments they needed from the sponsorship. And one of the most important things that came out of this was just the fact that this community, when they need to, when there is a need, we come together. You know, I think of Chazapalooza, and I think of, you know, the Walmer Walk for ALS, and all these other great things that happen with community involvement when people see a need. So, you know, we are not so small a community, or so big a community, rather, where we disregard the needs of our neighbors. And so I want to thank the Lions Club for putting that together, because, again, you know, this just shows that when people come together for a common cause, it works.
Amen to all that, Dave. Amen to all that.
So we want to move on, if we can. I want to talk a little bit about this pre-writ campaigning that's going on here in Northumberland, Peterborough South. Now, I've spoken to a number of people online to try and get the exact ruling with regards to what can and can be done, with regards to pre-writ campaigning, pre-writ electioneering. And my understanding is there's no problem with it. Now, you can't put up signs that say elect anyone yet, because there's no campaign, which I understand the Moulton signs down on King Street do have elect Adam Moulton, and I believe that is in contravention of the rules. But you know what? When has the Conservative Party ever allowed the rules to get in the way?
Well, this is a fascinating history, Dave. I really find it interesting, because if you go back to early 2000, the only reason you would see what you call a continuous campaign would be when there was a minority government.
Right.
So under those circumstances, there was usually a lot of politicking going on in between, because, of course, there was no fixed election date, and therefore anybody could defeat the government at any time, and you had to be election ready. So there was that kind of feel to it. And then as time passed, Stéphane Dion was elected as the Liberal leader. And that's where we saw the first time the Conservative Party of Canada make its move, and it had those attack ads. Do you remember those, Dave?
Yes, I do.
Now,
Chrétien talking out of both sides of his mouth, I surely remember.
Okay, so during that time where they went after Dion and with those ads, was the first time that they actually started to aggressively campaign prior to the writ being dropped.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I guess to just sort of follow through on the timeline, next, when Ignatieff took over, there was, again, do you remember the ads that the
Just visiting.
Yeah, all that stuff. That was the next example. And things started getting amped up. Well, once the fixed election date came in, this has changed the entire landscape. So what happens is that Elections Canada only applies once the writ is dropped. So there is absolutely no boundaries to what can be done. Now, you're right about the election signs, but that's considered election-related. Also, parties can create websites. Candidates can create websites. They can spend money if they want. But the thing is that when it comes time for the spending caps, that those kinds of expenses will be related to the campaign. And the reason I know that is because back in 2013, there was some fighting over pre-writ election spending in a by-election in Labrador.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened then was that the government, the conservatives, were going out and they were talking about the Muskrat Falls project, which was a $7.7 billion mm-hmm. mega project. There was a new Trans-Labrador Highway being built. And they were advertising and doing these things. And there was a fight over whether that was election spending. Elections Canada said, yes, those types of things are included and must be declared as part of the campaign spending. But it's gotten so fuzzy now that, for example, third-party spending. So unions and various organizations that may have party affiliation or share ideologies, they can now spend like crazy. And mm-hmm. you can see all sorts of editorials across the country saying, you know, this should be regulated. This is similar to the PACs.
There is the group called Engage Canada, which the Harper Conservatives have said is nothing more than a hidden agenda by big unions, which, again, is arguable given who contributes to Engage Canada. But so what they've done, there has been a conservative group, a group, and I'm going to say it, based out of the United States. These guys have come up here, and they've created what's called Harper PAC. And they've created Harper PAC to combat groups like Engage Canada or mm-hmm. Some of Us, which is another group out there that's protesting this government.
So there's no regulations in Canada around any of these organizations. In the States, there's a little bit more legal restraints around what they can do. But up here, there's none. So these guys get to spend any amount of money at any time, both before and during the campaign. Now, the campaigns themselves, they're out. We know that... For example, Kim Rudd's people are out knocking on doors right now. I haven't talked to anybody in the NDP whether they're door knocking, but I know that Rudd's campaign is very active and probably will go through till about the end of the month,
mm-hmm.
and then they'll take a break, and then most likely in August they'll start gearing up again, mm-hmm. and they'll hit the ground running hard.
Adam Moulton's had his team out. I know they were out on Saturday, the day before Father's Day, and the only reason I know this is because I have a family member who lives in an area that was door knocked by someone from the Adam Moulton team. So they're out there actively knocking on doors.
Well, and he's getting his office lined up in Coburg. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't miss it in the downtown. Big signs up there on Main Street. So that kind of activity is now taking place. So I hope that somewhat helps answer your question around the pre-writ election campaigning. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's anything that we can really do to stop these guys. The biggest fear in one of the papers that I read about it, an academic paper about it, was that that it wears out the voters. In other words, one of the reasons...
Campaign fatigue.
That's it. They said, you know, this was the big risk. But you know what? With this kind of targeted campaigning that the Conservatives are planning to do around highly focused riding by riding and worrying mm-hmm. about more mathematical outcomes than a general election outcome, I don't think they're as worried. Because you know what? If their message falls on deaf ears, they really don't care. It's their base that they want to get, and mm-hmm. and that's who they're campaigning to.
Well, and they also want to win some of the new 30 new seats
being
added to the House. So ours is one of them. Mm-hmm. Our riding's been redrawn. So we don't actually have an incumbent this time around. But it does raise the question. I mean, one of the things that led to a Conservative victory was this idea of targeted campaigning.
Yep.
They chose a very specific number of ridings where they were going to focus the big bucks on. We know that Guelph was one of them, hence the robocalls. And we know there's been a lot of hinky behavior on the part of the Conservative Party National Headquarters because of the way they've... I mean, let's face it. These guys have been found guilty of election fraud in every election they won. Every single one. Whether it's the In-N-Out scandal, whether it's robocalls, whether it's other campaign financing issues. I mean, so to expect a fair playing ground, if you will, from this particular government, I think is to expect, you know, sunshine every single day.
Well, and also, this whole notion that they're basing their campaign on this direct voter contact style where they have highly focused databases which tell them who's voting, who's somebody they can convert, who will not vote for them. And they can literally, household by household, voter by voter, get in there and figure out who they've got to go after and target their message specifically to them. So it's a very different campaign, and I think... You know, these are uncharted waters for Canadian voters. I mean, how do you respond when it's that targeted? You know, is my vote really going to count? And you know, the thing that, of course, you fear is that nobody's going to come out on Election Day.
Well, the question I have, and I want to know how the listeners feel about this, too, because one of the changes to the Fair Elections Act is going to allow election monitors from the various parties to be able to utilize handheld electronic devices in the polling station. Now, they're not going to be able to talk to people who are voting, but they are going to be able to note things like, you know, how many people have voted in this from this poll and pass that information around. So, again, the idea that they can sit in the polling station with their Apple iPads or their smartphones and use their SIMS program, which is what the conservative database is called, CIMS, I believe, SIMS. For me, that raises some alarm. So we're going to get back to that issue in just a moment, but we're going to take another quick break. We're going to pay some more bills. We'll be right back with more Consider This. And this is your Drive Time right here on Northumberland 89.7. And welcome back to the Drive Time right here on Northumberland 89.7. My guest in the studio, Rob Washburn, as always, on Wednesdays, Consider This Live from 6 till 7. We do have the lines open, 905-372-2321 or 905-372-2391. If you want to give us a call, give us a comment on any of the issues that we're talking about today.
Dave, what about the Art Gallery AGM tomorrow night?
Well, that should be a packed house. In my estimation, anyway, there should be a lot of people at the AGM. I guess you got to belong to the art gallery in order to attend, right?
Well, it'll be fascinating to watch what happens. They're making a number of changes to their bylaws, which I think are significant. They're looking at changing the composition of their board of directors. Mm-hmm. Previously, it was 15 members. Now they're saying there can be a minimum of 8 directors and a maximum of 15. The election, the annual general meeting, there's going to be limited terms, 1, 2, and 3-year terms, which they didn't have before. They are also removing the past president from their executive committee. They're also going to have 4 mandatory committees, which they had different ones. It used to be that they had the executive, finance, audit, those kinds of things. All were enunciating what they needed. Now they're saying, wait a minute, we've got to make sure that we've got these 4: finance, collections, governance, and fundraising. And then in addition to that, there'll be other committees like communications, events, and volunteers. So those are big changes. I think that's formalizing a lot of stuff. They're changing from a minimum of 2 to 1 director on each committee. They're also the board's changing the way that it has the ability to hire full-time, part-time, and contract employees. The board is going to now be able to approve job descriptions, remuneration, specific authority, responsibility for each employee. They're going to need 2 people to sign for contracts, deeds, transfers, licensing, engagements. All that kind of stuff now is going to be much, much more heavily regulated. So you can see the direction they're going in. I mean, obviously, the impact of the events of the last year have certainly shaken the organization to its core, mm-hmm. and these are the administrative things that are going to be brought forward. The other thing, as you and I well know from our interview with Deb McCarthy, that they've been meeting at her house for the last few months, and it's been the board that's been running the gallery. So it'll be interesting to see what they have to announce, what the fruits of those labors have been, mm-hmm. Over the last 3-4 months.
Well, and you know, you raise a good point. I mean, the fact that they're now really moving to what is a more substantive governance model is what we're seeing, as opposed to the way it was being run before, which, I mean, we have to look at the way it was run before. I mean, let's consider the fact that it was basically being run like a mom-and-pop operation, like a little family operation, if you will, where, you know, everyone was sort of allowed certain discretions, and there really was sort of inefficient oversight, and there was sort of this willingness on the part of the council representative to just say, hey, you guys go with it. I mean, that's the perception I got.
Well,
maybe I'm wrong.
I wouldn't be as harsh, Dave, but, you know, God bless you. but I would say more than that. I don't think there was anything wrong. I think what it was that, you know, why change anything when it's not broken? So people have gone on time and time again. There's nothing that was really challenging the board. Then all of a sudden, the events of the last couple of years took place, and there's been all of this scrutiny now, and obviously they're tightening things up, and as they should. I mean, this kind of review is absolutely critical. If they hope to go forward and do any more fundraising, they have to be able to say, hey, you know, we've tightened things up, and therefore we're worthy to be for you to donate to us because we're running a much tighter ship.
Absolutely.
And so I think these are really positive steps, and I'm sure they're done in good faith, and as was all the things that went on before. I mean, there was nothing really wrong. It was just that all of a sudden some things started happening, and the weaknesses within the system came obviously apparent, and now they're tightening it up.
Well, and good for them, because again, you know, what do they say? If you fail to plan, you plan to fail. So obviously they've got a comprehensive plan in place now that they want to move forward with, and they're going to talk about that at tomorrow's AGM. Something else that's happening tomorrow at an AGM is, of course, what's happening with Lakefront Utilities. And the fact that there's been this shortfall of some $776,000 from the Ontario Energy Board. They're saying that they've been shortchanged by Lakefront Utilities. Lakefront says that they're going to obviously pay back the money. But one of the other things that's sort of coming out about this issue is that that cost is going to be transferred to the ratepayers, to the customers of Lakefront Utilities. And my argument is we've paid our bills. You know, lack of planning on your part shouldn't constitute an urgency for me. And the idea that they're going to pass this cost on, this burden, if you will, onto their customers, quite frankly, in my opinion, is crap. I mean, surely they've been producing dividends on an annual basis. They've got a reserve pool themselves. Surely they can take the money that they've shortfalled the Ontario Energy Board and take that money out of their own profits. Why are they passing that on to customers?
Good points, Dave.
So that's going to come out tomorrow, and I know that some of the Cobourg councillors will be in attendance at that. And something that Ben Bird raised, the issue of, you know, there's 1 million shares in Lakefront Utilities right now, and the bulk of those are owned by the town.
Mm-hmm.
What's to stop them from issuing a single share to every customer so that the customer then can do things like attend the AGM and find out what's going on with this publicly owned utility? And I personally think that's a brilliant idea. I think it would be really, it would go a long way in assuaging some of the concerns that customers have, customers who own the utility, with regards to how things are being run.
Excellent idea. Ben's very good with ideas like that.
Mm-hmm. So we'll see if that actually comes to fruition or if that just dies again. But, you know, these are things that people are talking about. I mean, people are concerned. They're having trouble paying their utilities, a lot of people. We know that seniors aren't going to be able to eat the additional. I think it's probably going to work out to something like $13 more a month for the average ratepayer.
Well, and the logic which you explained it with earlier in regards to the fact that it's not like they haven't been getting any money. I mean, everybody, you know, you and I don't pay our bills. Guess what? We get cut off pretty quickly.
Right.
So I mean, people are you know, there's really no excuse for any of this. And the fact that, you know, Lakeshore Utilities tried to attend one of their meetings. I know I did as a journalist, and it wasn't always a welcome wagon to get in there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like too many of the boards, you know, this is why it's so important that we're all able to access minutes and, excuse me, get information from these organizations. It's because they are accountable to us. And it's if, you know, you try to get transparency and openness, and yet we can't even get the most basic information.
Well, no, exactly. And for instance, this is something that's been ongoing for a couple of years now. This, I believe, is 3 years old. I mean, if we'd known about this 3 years ago, it probably wouldn't be $770,000. It would probably be significantly less. This is the shortfall over the last 3 years.
Yep.
So what I've been doing all week long, and most people have probably heard me do this at least once in the hour, is recommend that the citizens, so the customers of Lakefront Utility, show up and attend the meeting. Now, they won't let you in the building, but you can surely occupy the street in front of the utilities and let them know that you don't want to have to pay for their mistake. And I think that's what we need to do, because it's the type of civil engagement that we see in other communities. You know, like Howard Beale said in the movie Network, we're mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore. And why should we, Rob?
I couldn't agree more, Dave.
So I don't know if I myself am going to be able to be down there, because I will probably be on air. I'm not sure what time the meeting is tomorrow at Lakefront Utilities. But if you are of a mind to say to these folks, say, you know what, I pay my bills. Why can't you pay your bills? And when I get shortchanged or I shortchange someone, I have to pay the freight. So why should you be able to pass that on to your customers? If you are like me and don't believe that that's something they should be able to do, then I would really urge you to attend Lakefront Utilities tomorrow. Again, I'm not sure of what time the AGM is. I think it's in the afternoon, around 5 or 6. But, you know, we need to voice our concerns. We need to tell this public utility, and we need to tell our government that, you know, we want responsible governance. We want a government that's responsive and reactive to the needs of our citizenry. And a lack of planning on your part should definitely not constitute an out-of-pocket urgency for me or for anyone else, for that matter. With regards to now today, Justin Trudeau says he's going to stop the bombing of ISIS. He says we're gonna pull the planes out of there. We're not going to do that. So that's been getting a lot of airplay from the Conservatives. But one of the things that he did also mention, which nobody else has bothered to talk about, is the fact that he's going to maintain our training force there. The Canadian forces will still be there to train the Iraqi soldiers. And you know my feeling on that one, listeners. I mean, Americans have been there for 13-odd years. Surely they've trained them well enough. I don't know what Canadians can teach them more. Maybe they're teaching them French. I don't know. But the fact is, Trudeau has said we're not going to pull the troops out. What we are going to do is end our cooperation or end our participation in the ongoing air campaign against ISIS and ISIL. And let's face it, they've only flown, I think, 4 sorties in a year and a half. 4 air missions. That's it. So if that's the case, we surely could get a bigger bang for our buck if we were simply to focus on the job of training Iraqi soldiers or training the coalition soldiers to fight this threat, this ISIS threat. Again, though, if you're like me, you don't probably consider it to be much of a threat. I think we've got more things to worry about domestically in this country than we do abroad.
Well, it's interesting, too, because I read in the Hill Times earlier this week that Trudeau is sort of looking at doing a policy statement each week up until the writs dropped. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be interesting to see how he starts to unfold. I mean, we've seen the whole fair and openness theme last week. The week before, it was all around economics, what they were going to roll back in terms of the tax-free savings accounts. Mm-hmm. And then the fairness theme was played. So it's interesting how he's approaching this. I know earlier in the week he was talking about a bit about the American-Canadian relationship and sort of changing the tone of discourse between the two countries. Mm-hmm. From sort of the belligerent heckling kind of thing that's been going on between Harper and mm-hmm. Obama around the Keystone Pipeline.
One of the things you said when we were talking before we went on air was the fact that, you know, there really hasn't been anything that sort of fires anybody up. There hasn't been anyone that lights a fire in the hearts of Canadians, not from Justin Trudeau, rather. Tom Mulcair, he's getting people fired up with his issues, obviously the Prime Minister. But I think you may be right. I think what we're seeing is a lot of really good governance policies.
Yep.
And really good ideas with regards to governance and taxation coming from the Liberals. But we haven't seen anything that's super sexy. And I think that's part of the problem the Liberals are facing right this moment.
And I can only imagine how that must play on the ground then in a campaign that's being run by the local candidate. I mean, mm-hmm. how much is she going to be able to depend on the leader to really pull her through this campaign, or is it going to be right on her doorstep, mm-hmm. and it's going to be a local campaign? I mean, a lot of people make decisions around who they vote for, looking at the national campaign as compared to the local one.
Right. No, you're absolutely right on that one. So again, it's going to be an interesting road that we're traveling down here, folks, because the bottom line is we have an election coming up, and we need to make sure that we know exactly what's happening. And right now, we don't. And so we're obviously going to have to wait and see how that plays out, because right now, as you said, and as we discussed during the break, it's going to be tough. It really is going to be tough. And so I guess we're going to have to leave it there, though, Rob, because
are we out of time?
We are just about out of time, listeners. You've been listening to The Drive Time. I'm your host, Dave Glover. With me, Rob Washburn. This has been Consider This Live. Here's BTO. You ain't seen nothing yet here on Northumberland 89.7. Stick around. Cedar Rail is on after 7 o'clock.
Northumberland 89.7 is CFWN, truly local radio, serving Northumberland County, a not-for-profit volunteer community radio station.